again, everyone. Debbie? So when I arrived this morning downstairs, and I was sure it was the right address, and I rang the button for the third floor, no answer. So I thought, oh, okay, well, maybe I didn't press hard enough. I waited a couple of seconds, pressed harder, waited again, and waited, and thought, do I have the wrong address? Is it not the right time? Is this the wrong day? Is there some other button to push to open the door? All kinds of things happening, so, in my head. And thinking I was arriving, I had thought I was very late. So I called Joan, no answer. I thought, wow, there's something really wrong here. So I called Krisha, no answer. And then just at this moment, Stephanie and Gilberto arrived. So I thought, okay, well, there must be something right here if they're arriving now too, huh? So, unless they're in the wrong place at the wrong time too, so. And we barely had time to start chatting, and then Krisha called and said, oh, I'm at the coffee. I didn't understand what that meant. I thought she was having coffee here and she had to come down and open the door or something. And it was very confusing, and she said, no, I'm coming. And she came running then from the cafe. And I thought, oh, we're the first ones. And then we come up the stairs and I hear people talking. I recognize the voices, and there were already people here. I thought, okay, this is stranger than I thought it was. How did they get in if Krisha was not here? There must be some trick. The only trick I heard was that the door was open, or Isabel opened the door somehow and let people in. I don't understand exactly what happened, but all of this to say that things are not what we think they are. Ever. And we start with these stories of I'm late, wrong place, wrong time, the button doesn't work, all kinds of things that we start telling. That thoughts are bringing me to these different places. And then I arrive here and it's like, oh, there are people here already. I'm coming late to the party or something. And this is the story kind of our lives. There's this French mystic Jesuit who was quite famous. I don't know if he was famous in Portugal as well. Théard de Chardin. And he has this great phrase that is, we are not human beings living a spiritual experience. We are spiritual beings living a human experience. That changes everything if we see it that way. We usually are so caught up in what we think of as this human, of who we are. We're so identified with this. And then occasionally there's a little opening and we think, oh yes, this is, you know, some kind of spiritual experience or some beautiful moment or something is clear, the resistance drops or something. And we think that's exceptional. Actually, it's the other way around, that we are, that is what we are, but we're having this human experience. So the spiritual aspect, the spiritual experience is unlimited, timeless, no characteristics, no individual personal characteristics, vast, deep, more profound than we can imagine, unthinkable, all of these things, ungraspable. It's what we call the absolute sometimes. Whereas the human experience is limited in time and in space. We're very familiar with the limited, this limited space, this limited form, this limited space, this the wider limited space of the city we're in, the language we're speaking, the country, the neighborhood, and then everything that goes with that. We're very, very familiar with all of that human experience. And our mistake, if you will, is that we are thinking that that's what we are, and we are missing what we think we are not. We don't think that we're limitless. We don't think that we are free. We don't think that we are beyond space and time. So we think that we're late. We think we have the wrong address. We think that there's some mistake. We think we have all this confusion going on in our mind, when actually it's none of that. It's not what we think it is. It's not what I thought it was, right? There's also the beautiful story of when the guy who became known as the Buddha, who after much struggle, much effort, seeking to understand, you know, why people get old, why there is sickness and why there is death, trying to understand these very basics of human experience, of this limited human experience, tried everything he could think of, everything that was available to him, whether it be an ascetic practice of denying the body, depriving the body, denying the limited existence, which of course we know doesn't work. We can't deny this. This is what we are experiencing at this moment. We know that, you know, the best example of impermanence is to look at our own life and see that we get old, we get sick, we will die. So he wanted to understand that, tried everything he could think of, until finally he just stopped, dropped it, and said, I'm just going to sit here and see what happens. So at this famous moment that has become famous, he sees the morning star, and he says, this is wonderful, how wonderful this is. I and all sentient beings, all beings throughout space and time, awaken simultaneously. And often this is interpreted as, so he got it, and therefore everybody else wakes up, or something like that. But it's actually kind of like my experience coming up the stairs and seeing that everybody's already here, right? It's like, ah, I see. Everybody's already awakened. I'm the one that's not. I'm the one that didn't see it. Everybody else is already awakened. Of course, he's not saying everybody sees it, because we know, most of us, we don't see it. We don't see the spiritual experience. We don't see this, who we truly are. But when we do, we see that everybody is that too, that it's not just me, and that I'm kind of coming late to the party. So I come up the stairs and everybody's already here. I didn't know that. And then we can see all the problems we create in our lives and then in the world when we don't see this. Or when we see, when we say, okay, yeah, okay, I get it, everything is one, everything's perfect, great, I can love my neighbor, whatever. But then when the slightest little thing comes to contradict that, or things don't go how we want them to go, or as we see, you know, war rages, we're destroying the planet, people, there are poor people, there are starving people, we see all of this stuff that arises, then we forget very quickly all of the spiritual stuff and become involved with more of the violence and the separations and the divisions and the, and identify with that once again. And so we sometimes, when we're dealing with these human affairs, there's this phrase in English that we say, think outside the box. I don't know if you have an equivalent type thing in Portuguese, which it's very interesting because thinking outside the box requires us to let go of our usual human behavior of knowing the rules, knowing the patterns, sticking to what is familiar, keeping all of our reference points. And thinking outside the box requires us to let go of all of that. It requires the equivalent of stepping back. We take, you know, we say in our practice, take a step backwards. And we know, often, when we say, think outside the box, we know that's where we find solutions. That's where problems seem, they look different when we think outside the box, and that's what people do it, or suggest it. Or there used to be this early, kind of maybe in the 90s, late 90s, early 2000s, advertising campaign for Apple. And it, so it would have a picture of Gandhi, and it would say, think different. Or it would have a picture of Martin Luther King. Think different.
I had a dream.
What?
I had a dream.
Yeah, right.
It was an Apple computer.
Yeah. Well, you know, sometimes these advertising slogans, well, there's something to that, you know. And the people they chose to, they did think differently, those people who they chose to put on those posters. At some point, there was a picture floating around of when one of my teachers, Bernie Glassman, was visiting us in Paris around that time. And we were out walking, and somebody took a picture of him, like, standing in front of that advertisement, but you couldn't see the face of Gandhi or whoever it was. It was him, and then it said, think different next to him. And he was someone who thought different, born of his experience of being a spiritual being, having a human experience. So knowing that you are the spiritual being allows you to experience this humanness differently, to not be caught by the separations, by the attachments, by the rejecting or grasping, not being caught by the mass consumption, the celebration of a limited I of me, thinking outside the box, thinking differently, connecting with the spiritual experience, the spiritual being who's experiencing this, widens the perspective and helps us to see this in a different way. And that's where we then can act in a different way as well. I read a story recently, as everyone, you know, I'm reading all of the news and everything I can find, or not, about the various tragedies of our current times. But this one was a story about two women who are lawyers In one is an Israeli Jew and one is an Israeli Palestinian, and the Israeli Jewish woman's father was one of the human rights lawyers who helped develop the Oslo Accords, which the Oslo Accords were in the early 90s. That was when the two-state solution for Palestine and Israel was developed with Yasser Arafat and Yitzhak Rabin, and it was a moment of great promise. So he, this human rights lawyer, was one of the ones who helped create that. And his daughter, he has now died, but his daughter is now a human rights lawyer, young, 35 maybe. And she and this Palestinian woman, who's also a lawyer, have this shared view of thinking outside the box, because they say everything that's in the box is not possible, not valid. No, there's no way. The two-state solution, as we envisioned it, is not going to happen, right? Because there are millions of Palestinians who live in Israel, and there are thousands and thousands of Israelis, Jews, who live in the West Bank, who live in the colonies that have been established, who live in Palestinian territory. And there's no way any of those people, and it doesn't make sense actually, to uproot them all and switch. It's just not going to happen, a two-state solution. So their suggestion their sense of thinking outside the box is a federation on the European model. This sounds completely insane, right? But the Israeli woman said, if you had said 80 years ago that there would be young Germans living and working happily in France, and young French people living happily, freely, living and working happily and freely in Germany, everyone would have said you were crazy. No way. It's not going to happen, you know? And yet, that's reality. All of these Europeans who live in all these different countries, live and work in these different countries, no problem, right? Of course, there might be problems, but we won't talk about the UK in this situation because they decided there were problems, so they don't do this anymore. But everyone else, okay, you do it. And as they said, if this were to be the situation in Israel-Palestine, there would be two states, but you could live wherever you wanted. However, you could only vote in your native country. So the Israeli Jews could only vote in Israel. The Israeli Palestinians, if they chose to be Israeli, could only vote in Israel. And the Palestinians, or whoever wanted to become a Palestinian nationality, could only vote in Palestine. Because this is one of the great fears for Israel, is that if they did allow, you know, if they did allow it to be one state shared power, that they would be in the minority and they would lose all of their rights and things. So this is one way of seeing it. Maybe it's a complete fantasy. Maybe it's, you know, I have a dream. But it's interesting, the idea of thinking out the box, outside of the box, and opening to, oh, yeah, well, maybe there is another possibility, because it seems so hopeless when we're caught in our human limitations. It seems there's no possibility. There's no solution. It seems like there's just more violence that creates more violence, creates more violence. And I'm sure we could find similar, for many of the crises in our world today, find similar ways of thinking out the box, outside the box. And a lot of people are doing that, are trying to do that, think outside the box. In various situations, whether it be dealing with poverty, dealing with drug addiction, whether it's dealing with the climate situation, whether it's, and I'm just pointing out the crises. It's not only when there's a crisis that we can think outside the box. The finest artists think outside the box. And that's how they create such magnificent works. They think outside the box. They're not caught by the limited, the limited human being that we think we are. As you've maybe heard me say, I don't remember when I mentioned this, maybe it was in writing workshop, I don't know, that Michelangelo, marvelous, you know, exquisite pieces of sculpture, right? And he said that he didn't actually create the sculptures, you've heard this, yeah. He just chipped away at the marble and what was already there was revealed. This requires enormous thinking outside the box, deep trust in what is, in the not knowing what will arise. The spiritual being knows by not knowing. The human being knows by understanding. So knows by knowing. And actually, we need both. And it's not like these are two different beings. This is one being, okay? So the spiritual being is having a human experience. And in order to have that human experience, has to be one with the human. And as a human, if we're limiting ourselves to this human experience, this human being, and we have a spiritual experience, we tend to think of it as being separate, something outside of what we actually are of our life. Although in that moment we feel something, some wholeness, some oneness. And that's why it feels so good, and that's why it seems so beautiful. But from the spiritual being's point of view, there is no separation. There is no difference. It's all one, all the time. And therefore includes the human experience. Includes the human being. Like I said at the beginning of the day, we chose to be here, right? We chose to be this today. So really be it. We always are being it, but we don't usually pay attention to that. We usually think, I'm doing this. We don't think of it as, I'm being this. Think, I'm doing this sitting. I'm doing this day of practice. I'm going to there. Where instead of being it, I am being this now. I'm being this sitting. I'm being this day. I am being this listening. I am being this speaking. I am being it. That's where the spiritual being is active, in that being. So we can hear all of this, and we had yesterday our text in the study group. I think there was only Marlene and Debbie who were there in the study group. This little short story from Sri Ramakrishna, who was a Hindu guru in India in the 19th century. Talked a lot through parables, and so this parable was of a story, he actually said, it was one of his disciples who had sat and heard this kind of talk, right? The spiritual being, the oneness, the non-separation, heard all of this, and then at the end of the teaching, or maybe several teachings, I don't know, and in the Hindu tradition, or for Sri Ramakrishna, it would be the Brahman, right? So when we talk about oneness, or we would talk about the absolute, or we would talk about Mu in the Zen tradition, they talk about, in the Hindu tradition, it's Brahman, right? So everything is Brahman, Brahman is one, everything. So the disciple hears this and goes out, leaves, and is walking down a road, a very narrow road, and there's an elephant arriving in the middle of the road, and there's the the Maut, who's the guy who takes care of the elephant riding on it, and shouts to the disciple, hey, you, get out of the way. This elephant is not, this is not a nice elephant. And the disciple thinks to himself, well, everything is Brahman. I don't need to get out of the road. Nothing can happen to me because I see that. I see that everything is Brahman. And so stays, and the elephant comes up and swats him with his trunk, and the disciple is thrown to the side of the road and very upset, and goes back to Ramakrishna and says, you know, Master, you said that everything is Brahman, Brahman is all, Brahman is perfect, or whatever it was. And is that not true? And Ramakrishna says, yes, it is true. And the disciple says, well then, you know, I was walking down the road and the Mahout told me to get out of the way, and there was the elephant because there was the elephant, but I didn't because everything's Brahman, and how could that happen to me then? And Ramakrishna said, oh, you stupid man. The Mahout too is Brahman. And when he's telling you to get out of the road, you have to pay attention to it and react accordingly. So if we think that, oh, okay, I'm the spiritual being and I don't take into account the human experience, well, that's where we get in a lot of trouble. We can see immediately then that in a sense, and I know this is quite provocative when I say that, but if we don't take into account, if we only experience our spiritual being and don't take into account, like when the Mahout is warning him, if we don't take into account the human situation of this moment, of this limited world, then we end up with totalitarianism, we end up with Auschwitz, we end up with wanting, with not seeing the differences and appreciating them, of not behaving according to the situation. Or like the poet Gary Schneider said, wisdom, so that's the spiritual being, is in this sense represents wisdom, of seeing the oneness and the wholeness of things, without compassion, so without taking into account the human world, the human experience, feels no pain. Wisdom without compassion feels no pain. And so therefore that's dangerous. Because then we don't know, we don't acknowledge suffering. We don't acknowledge our own pain and suffering, we don't acknowledge the other's pain and suffering. And we do can do great harm. You know, apparently someone was telling me yesterday, in fact, that a journalist who was allowed to see some of the images of the Hamas massacres in the kibbutz, right, said he had never seen anything like that. He'd never seen such horror in all his life as a journalist. And my immediate thought is, and I said this to the person who was telling me this, is that that is an example of, if you can inflict that kind of pain and suffering on another being, you are clearly not seeing the human, what it means to be human, and you are not seeing what it means to be a spiritual being either. There's a definite blindness there. Of course, we know this. We don't even have to take that extreme example. But it is an extreme example. And then we know that when we respond to those horrors, we tend to, if we become blinded and we don't see the human and spiritual as well, clearly, then we will inflict new harm. And then there is new harm that comes back, and it's usually greater. So there's like a, like in an auction. You know what an auction is, where the price just keeps going up, you know? It just keeps going up. And so at some point, if we're very lucky and we're involved in something like that in our lives, if we're very lucky, or if we can sit down and just pay attention for a moment, we can see what's happening. You know, it's like coming up the stairs and saying, oh, okay. Or Krisha arriving in the situation suddenly makes sense, you know. I heard the teacher, I listened for the first time ever, and this is quite unusual, I suppose, I listened for the first time ever to an interview with Adi Ashanti, who is this great teacher, you know, that everyone has talked about for years and years and years and years, and I just never listened to him. So he was being interviewed by this guy, by Sam Harris, who's another person that everybody talks about, and I had never heard of him. So I listened to this interview. And he... he tells his story that he was this professional bike racer, so high-level athlete, trained, worked out, wanted in the way to be the best racer was to really practice all the time and ride all the time, and he spent 8 hours a day working out, doing all this.
Sorry, what is a racer?
What?
Ciclista.
Oh, okay, racer.
Bicycle.
Okay.
And young, you know, 20 years old, something like that, and had, I forget, somebody gave him a book or something, I don't know what book it was, something, and he heard about meditation, and he tried it, and he kind of liked it, but he was doing it on his own, and he didn't really know anything about it, so he just looked in the, it was a book by Ram Dass, and in the back of the book, this is in the old days when there was no internet or anything, and in the backs of books like that sometimes, they would have a list of places you could go or to find meditation things. It was that limited, you know, in those days. And so he looked, and on that list, there was someone not far from his home. This woman who just in her living room like this had people come. And so he went there. And this woman was actually a disciple of Maizumi Roshi, who is the one who brought our lineage from Japan to California. And so he started practicing Zen. And he did this for 3 years. And he did it with the same approach that he approached bike racing. Super discipline, really intense, like hours he would meditate, and he set up this little hut in his parent, he was living with his parents, and he set up this little cabin in the garden that was his meditation hut, and really, really intense. And like his teacher or this woman was kind of trying to say, you know, cool it, you know, settle down a little. You know, like, you can take it easy too, you know. It doesn't have to be this intense, you know. But no, that was the only thing he knew, was that that's what you did. So he tells a story that one day, after 3 years of doing this, he goes out to his meditation hut, and he goes in there, and he's just really discouraged. He's like, this is just not happening, you know. He didn't even really know what he was looking for. I can't remember how he phrased what he was looking for, but he didn't really know what it was. But he said, you know, this is just not going anywhere. I can't do this anymore. Something like that. So he said, he sat down on his cushion and he said, I just can't do this anymore. And that's when, boom. As we say, the skies opened, you know, everything became clear. He had this amazing spirit, a human having a spiritual experience. I'm sure he was thinking of it in those terms. He probably wouldn't phrase it that way. He was thinking of it, he had been this human trying to have a spiritual experience, right? And then this happens, and he sees, he understands that he's actually a spiritual being, and he'd been caught up in this human experience, right? So why did I tell the Adyashanti story? The thing of something about letting go. Oh, I guess maybe letting go of all of the human stuff that we're thinking and believing. Belief is a big one. This word came up yesterday in our study group that for example, for Christians, you know, they believe in God, they believe in the afterlife, they believe in they have a number of beliefs, and the other monotheistic religions also have these series of beliefs. Whereas this practice of ours is not about believing, it's about experiencing. So we have to let go of our beliefs in order to experience. I'm not asking you to believe a word of what I'm saying, actually. And I would prefer that you don't believe it, actually. I can't stop you from believing it, and I don't have any interest in stopping you from believing it. However, for your path, it's better not to believe it. From my experience of this path, it's better not to believe what other people say, what the books say, you know, what someone is saying you should do or should not do, and experience it for yourself. It helps to hear these people say these things, and you hear the same things over and over again, but it helps. It really does help, you know, and I sit down and I listen to Adyashanti, and that's really illuminating for me to hear what he says. Maybe it's nothing that I didn't already know, but it's another way of opening the mind to it, you know, which helps me then get out of the box that I'm in, because I'm always in a box of some kind, right? And I don't come to Adyashanti, listen to Adyashanti thinking he's going to wake me up, or he's going to save me, or he's going to change my life or something. No. I'm genuinely interested to hear what he has to say and then see how I experience that. And I encourage you to approach whatever you read and hear in the same way. You know, in our language we have, at least probably in Portuguese it's the same way. You know, when we have the third person, the second person, and the first person, when we conjugate
verbs,
right? So, and so, you know, the third person is talking about someone or something. The second person is talking to, so you. The first person is, the third person is he, she, it, they. The second person is you. And already that's closer than he, she, it, they, right? That you is, in writing workshops, I have this exercise sometimes where I have people write about someone, you know, there's a person that they've taken, that they're gonna write about. And the first version that they write is he, she, or they did this, they did that, he did this, she did that, whatever, the person. And then I say, okay, the same person, but this time you. So you think that you did this, you did that, you were there. Already that's closer. And we can even feel it in our hearts, kind of, that there's a distance in the he, she, it, they that there isn't with you. And then the first person, it's I. Even closer. So in the writing workshop, then I have them write I. They tell the same story, but from I. Very different. Very, very different. Same goes with this, you know. So you hear about something. I'm saying it to you, so you're receiving it. This is closer than when you're reading a book, maybe, or when you're watching on YouTube. We're sitting in the same room. We're only a few meters apart. It's closer. It's you. And then when you take it as I, as me, and you know, again, Théard de Chardin had this thing, similar thing of the three faces of God, where he had Jesus, he pointed out that Jesus talked about God, Jesus talked to God, and Jesus talked as God. And in pointed this to everyone. And when he could say, you know, you are the light or you are the way, he's addressing the second person but pointing towards the first. So can you say, I am the light? I am the way. I am it. You know? My Dharma name is You Are It. My teacher gave me that name. And as I've said, it's because I was caught on the I am it at that time. And so it was very astute of her to give me you are that. Which is the same thing. But it helps us to think outside the box of I. Now it helps me to go outside this box of I am it to you are it. And yet I am you, so I am it too. So from the spiritual being has no difficulty with this whatsoever. In the human experience, it makes no sense. And yet we can see, you know, when we see an example of, for example, you know, climate change, the whole crisis, the whole debacle, you know, the whole disaster that we've created, and we can see that we're not separate. We're not separate from other people, but we're not separate from other living organisms, beings. We're not separate from, you know, we say, okay, the air is really polluted in Paris, which is true. Terrible, terrible polluted air in Paris. But it's the same air that's here, it's just different conditions at that moment that it's all one, right? So from the human experience, it's different places and different situations, but it's all one air. And we are not apart from what we think of as nature, we are nature. We are the biosphere, as we say. We think that we're outside of it, we're an exception or something, but we're not. So this what the spiritual being knows, the human experiences without paying attention to it, without really understanding it, because it makes no sense from the human way of thinking. It makes no sense that we're not separate. And yet the evidence is there every moment. You know, we had the extreme example with COVID too. During the height of the COVID infections, we would not have been sitting in this room together like this because we would have all been infecting each other. And we know that. And who knows, maybe we're all infecting each other now too with something else or that or something else. What? What?
Are we the COVID?
Well, we don't know. But, you know, but we do. It makes sense to us in that sense when we know that that's what happens. And those are just like two examples. There are many others, though, you know, that from, you know, if I'm in the apartment where I'm staying, I can sometimes hear the people upstairs. And the people under me can probably hear me. Because actually, we're all one there in that building. No? We have these separations that we think separate us, but we're all one. Someone told me, who studies these things, that, and I'll have to ask Nuno about this too, that apparently if we could, and we can't, if we could travel at the speed of light, everything and everyone would all be in the same place at the same time. There would be no other place, no other time. There would be no space and time, in fact, if we could travel at this. Everything at once, which is, that brings us back to the Buddha's experience. Science has to come to this by all kinds of formulas and experiments and things like that. And it's limited too by, then it doesn't really have an explanation for what that means beyond the formulas and the numbers and things. Whereas the Buddha comes to this experience of everyone awakened throughout space and time simultaneously by just sitting under a tree for the night. Of course, he had been sitting for days and weeks and months and years and gone through all kinds of practices, but in fact, he just came to it by letting go and moving outside the box, as it were, let's say. The physicists, you know, the astrophysicists who got to this point of saying this also thought outside of the box. They didn't start with saying, we want to prove that, you know, they make a hypothesis, but often in their experiments, they find something else. They prove their hypothesis wrong and they find something else. You know, they stumble upon something else. Which is, you know, what is kind of the same thing we do. You know, Adi Ashanti has this real fixed idea, even though he can't really formulate what it is he's looking for, but he has somewhere this idea of what he's doing, and only actually finds what he's looking for, which he didn't know that's what he was looking for, until he stops looking for what he thought he was looking for. Right? It sounds like Zen jargon, but that's it, you know? Like Michelangelo with his slab of marble. Or I'm doing the same thing at the moment with my writing. So I came here to do this month of writing, translating, being with all of you. I have no idea what I'm doing with the writing. I have no clue. Except that I don't have a clue. And that I'm like Michelangelo, just chipping away, right? And it helps to, so if I come back to that, just that story, taking myself outside of the box of my home, my usual office, my usual daily life, my family, my city, my activities, my usual shops and food and everything. If I take myself out of that box, put myself into this other box in Lisbon, take away all the, and it's not, of course, it's a box, but it doesn't have the same feel as a box because it's all new, it's all different. I don't have my usual points of reference. And so that helps me to then come out of my, to think outside my box. And we do the same thing with sitting, okay? So we, today we chose to be in this box, to be this box. It's different. Come outside the other box. When we sit down on our cushions, we do the same thing, okay? Sit here, and this is something I'm letting go of my usual points of reference, although we very quickly have points of references when we sit. Things we usually do, things we're familiar with, places we go, getting lost in our thought, falling asleep, usual stuff. But probably already the second period of sitting was different than the first in that respect. And then after the break, a different experience. If we really pay attention, it's different all the time. And the the very basic, simple form and structure of sitting can be a really powerful method to get us think outside the box. And to even this notion of, you know, thinking of the human experience and the spiritual being instead of the human being and the spiritual experience, if we could just swap them, you know, that takes us really out of the box that we're usually in. Even if we're not quite sure what that means. But it does provide some space. It does open something there. So I don't know the time, but maybe I'll open it up to questions, comments.
You were talking about beliefs and letting go of beliefs, and I think most of the practice is about letting go of all ideas. I think this was when I was very much involved in ecology, and I bumped into a psychologist or something, and he was very great. He was saying that all our actions come from emotions, and our emotions come from belief systems. So basically, we all have a belief system, but most of us are not aware of it. So it's something almost that we don't choose to not to have. It's just almost ingrained in us. We believe the sky is blue. We believe our culture is this. So I didn't thought about any question. It was just, because the other day I was talking a lot about that. We really need to be aware of our belief system in order to work with it, or to relate with it, because it can be a very good one if it helps us to go on our path, or it can be harmful. But the belief system will be there like a refuge. We always have a refuge. The refuge can be Buddha, or it can be our partner, or our job, or our idea of what we want to be. So the belief, it will always be there, isn't it? It's like the root base of our humanness, or not. What is your...
That's an interesting point, and in that I guess what happens is when we become caught by the beliefs and that limits us, you know, we believe that... So if we take Israel and Palestine, you know, if we believe that the Jewish people have a right to that land and nobody else can live there, we'll have problems. And if we believe the opposite, the Palestinians have a right to that land and nobody else can live there, there's problems. If I believe that the only true path is Zen the way that I practice it, trouble. I will eliminate everything that doesn't fit with my belief. and I will contest anyone who doesn't believe what I believe, and I might even fight and die for those beliefs. Whereas, as you say, yes, we can. It can be helpful to believe certain things, and it depends, I guess, how we use the word belief. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm not sure for how a psychologist uses a belief system.
Because you were saying, be careful with the word belief.
Right. So I think that's true. That we have to understand what we're talking about when we talk about beliefs. Someone in the group yesterday gave the example of, I believe that I'll take another breath, and so I will live, you know. And that's not really what it is. Our experience is that we breathe. We don't believe it so much. If there was some theory that a human being, in order to live, had to breathe, and we somehow didn't know that, then some people would choose to believe it or not. And they might even fight over believing that, that their belief was different than the others, and therefore they were going to kill each other because they didn't believe the same thing. But we don't even need to believe that, because it is. We are that. We are our breath. We are breathing. The sky is blue. Yeah, okay. We believe the sky is blue. I don't know. You know, our experience is that we see it as blue. It's actually not blue. Scientifically, it's not blue. It's just the combination of our eye, the lenses in our eye, and the light that create that image that it's blue in the atmosphere, but it's not actually blue. So I guess it depends how we understand the word belief.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Basically, the danger is that if it creates separation.
You're right, if we become attached to it, yeah. Become attached to our belief, mm-hmm. Absolutely.
There are some... Yeah, scientifically, science is supposed to be a way to have good beliefs, but even in science, people get caught up in definitions, very strict definitions of science, and then they exclude all other possible explanations.
Right, exactly. They become limiting then, the beliefs. Yeah, absolutely. When we become fixed on it. And, you know, we can say, okay, I believe there should be peace in the Middle East or something. That's more like that's what I'm thinking. That thought comes from my experience of what peace is and what harm is and what violence is or something. And my experience is that violence is not an answer to create peace or something. I could say I believe that, but I say that because it's my experience, something like that.
It's just thinking about the limits of imagination and how the expression of thinking outside the box already presupposes the image of a box that we need to think outside of, right? And that indeed perhaps makes it very human, I suppose, that a spiritual being or somebody accessing this through the spiritual side will be able to conjure up a different form of imagination that doesn't even involve a box as a referent to think outside of.
Yeah, the spiritual being, there is no box.
Yeah.
There's no inside or outside.
Mm. Yeah. It must be fun.
Well, the thing is, it's not if it's only spiritual. If it's only the spiritual being, it becomes fun or joyful, or there is love, or there is tears, there's joy, there's suffering in the experience, in the human experience. There's no way to experience any of that, only the spiritual being. Like we said, the spiritual being feels no pain, but feels no joy either, no fun.
So is that wisdom without... No, that's not wisdom without
Sorry.
Compassion. That's not wisdom
it
without...
It is, yeah.
It is.
Yeah.
I was thinking about this breathing process and beliefs. Not for a long period. I don't have this asthmatic sorts. But I remember when I had them... it was so extreme to be there, and it was not a belief, because it was so hard to have this last breath. I would never dare to say I am going to breathe again. You are just in the process, you know. It was really this not a belief, but even so, there is a kind of a belief. I am breathing, but will I breathe again? Yeah.
So you had a doubt that you might not breathe again?
Yes.
Several times.
I kind of have the same experience when I have asthma too, and sometimes it feels like it depends on my mindset or something.
Yeah.
But you are afraid that you are going to die?
Not afraid, but it's you know, you are in a very extreme process.
You are very vulnerable.
Yeah, sure.
The struggle.
Well, and when you said that, I thought of when I was very ill with COVID. And so I was confronted with my belief that, because there were moments when I thought I might not make it, you know, I might die. But really, I didn't know. I was so sick, and it was a time when nobody knew anything about COVID, and everyone was hysterical, and lots of people were dying, and you couldn't get in the hospitals and whatever. So nobody knew, and I was plunged into that directly because I was so sick, right? And so there was that phase of, I don't know. And first there was the phase of, what? How can this be happening to me? How can this is not happening to me? How can I be one of these people? Because as it was arising, the COVID, and we were hearing these stories, I was like, yeah, okay, fine. It'll just be a little flu or something, you know, fine, it's not gonna happen. I even had a doctor who's, you know, a real snobby doctor in Paris, who said to me, I think it was in February of 2020, in one of the fancy neighborhoods of Paris, and I asked her, so what do you think about this COVID thing, you know? And he said, oh, it's not in this arrondissement that you will catch COVID. It's not in this arrondissement, in this fancy neighborhood, that you will catch COVID. 6 months later, when I saw her, she had really bad COVID.
Maybe she left the arrondissement.
Yeah, maybe she did. Yeah. Who knows where she was going, right? Yeah. But, so I had that... this really, you know, like, offended, thinking, how can this be happening to me? My belief was that it was not going to happen to me, obviously. I had this really strong belief about it. And we all had lots of beliefs about COVID at the time. And we still do, and you saw what happened. People were, like, really lots of bad stuff doing to each other because of their beliefs. But and so there was that phase of, I just can't believe this, you know. This can't be happening to me. And then, but this was also to do with the doubt of, am I going to survive? I don't know, because it just kept going on, you know? And then there was this letting go of, I don't know. And it's okay. I'm no different than anyone. It was like such a relief to no longer have to believe I was different than somebody else, you know, to just be, I'm just like everybody else. And it's hard to even put it into words, the depth of that experience, but there is this process of, I don't know if I will take another breath. I don't know if I will wake up tomorrow morning. I don't know if I will see my children grow. I don't know if I will have a grandchild, which I will have a grandchild in January, but I believe that I will, but who knows what will happen, you know. And then there's the moment of just this, you know. And I looked at the pit from my window. I could see in Paris it was really strict. You couldn't even go out inside and... So the children were playing in the garage parking lot behind the building next door because they couldn't go anywhere else. And I watched these people every day out there. And there was something just so, so beautiful and joyous about it, even though I was, you know, thinking I might die the next day. So, but that all involved letting go of my belief that I was different, that this wasn't going to happen to me. Even believing in that I would have another breath. Just letting go.
Yeah. Did you finish? Mm. Sorry. I don't quite remember, but I wanted to share two things. Let me see if I can. One is about thinking outside the box with no box involved. And it was with you, and it was so puzzling. in a koan. It was the first one, the Mu. And then the Mu kinds of have some sequences. Never mind, but she will ask you directly stuff. And your mind wants to answer the stuff. Yeah. Then she asked me something like, I don't know, what color are you? Is this possible? I don't know. But then I was thinking, well, she's American. She will. Is it for me to answer I'm mixed or not? Because they are, you know, you go there and you have to cross. You are half here, half there, which is really strange for you Portuguese. But then there was another place. It was really funny. The answer came from my belly. There was another part of my body that was answering, and I didn't want it to, I wanted to hide it, because my first reaction was kind of shame and not understanding what is this, and then trust, just give her the answer, stop stop thinking. And it was, well, it doesn't happen all the time, and sometimes it feels like closes. I don't know when it opens, when it closes, but it's much more about attachments. I think when you are thinking in beliefs, in Portuguese it will be crenças, mm-hmm. and it's about our conditioning, patterns, whatever. And I, this summer, I was reading Elizabeth Strout, which I... it's a new writer for me, but she's really tough because she's always talking about bad childhood, bad mothers, and then she's dying on the hospital. And her mother goes to visit her. And you know, her mother is horrible. She just did the horrible stuff, but she really cherished, she is really happy to be there with her mother. It's all that she wants. And it almost felt like with no attachments, and then she started to speak a lot of stories about people with tough lives and how they believe they have a big belief of loneliness and not being enough or not loved, and they would just want the opportunity to have something that they missed. And I have a mother, as everybody else is, and I don't, for me sometimes it's difficult to be with her. But I love my mother, and I completely understand that book. I just want to be with her. And there's some spaces that I can actually be with her. Imagine, we went to a cinema where she can discorrer, talk about how wonderful this guy is, and me and my friends, so when I was young, I was here, and I done this, and you have to admire her and be with her. But I just love it, you know. I found a space there where I could be with no attachments. The stuff about okay, she's not seeing me, she's not interested in what I'm doing, whatever my complaints are. I just, you know, was open to the moment, and I really cherish behind my beliefs. I think it was about, I miss her, I just want to be with her with whatever it's possible. And this is possible, and I'm not feeling conflicted or with no attachments. I'm not needing something else that she can't give. I just want to be in this kind of space of love and joy and be here, fully here. So I do think beliefs sometimes are... Oh, another thing. Part of my path about my beliefs is reminding me they are not true. You are feeling this, you're completely argumenting, you see, but it's a lie, it's not true, it's not happening, it's about your attachments, it's about, and it's interesting, most of the time I can do it, but sometimes I can be there, I think how I was with my mother, really be there.
Well, and so if I'm following what you're saying, so the when you talk about answering from your belly,
mm-hmm.
and you use the word trust,
mm-hmm.
so, and then, and that's very important to however you want to call that, answering from the belly, however.
It felt.
That, exactly, right. That is really, that's what we're looking for, because that's where our true, that's who we truly are, that's where the truth is, that's the wholeness, that's the spiritual experience being comes, that's it there, in that, what you're talking about, this belly. Even if you don't think, maybe other people don't think of it as being in the belly, but whatever it is. And everybody, we've all experienced these kinds of moments. When you go then towards your mother and let go of the ideas and the, all the experiences you have with her and whatever resistances and whatever, and you just go and you just connect with, you love her and you want to be there with her in that place, that is coming, that's this, a similar type letting go of beliefs of the spiritual being is the one that makes that possible, in other words, something like that. Even if you don't experience it as being a spiritual experience, but it's that aspect of yourself that allows you to do that, to let go.
But should we always trust our gut instinct?
Yeah, the gut is
no.
The gut is the that's true, that's the one normally. Well, you know, it depends. On one hand, we could say yes. However, I don't know how we define our gut instinct. The more that we do it, the more that we recognize when we can trust it. You know, I use the example of coming here for this month. I started thinking about this. This idea came to me in July. Like that kind of a gut thing. And didn't really know, but I trusted it because I know I have enough experience sitting here, you know, years and years, 30 years of sitting here on this cushion and you know, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of koans, and this koan practice really helps us to realize this, recognize this gut when it's true and when it's not. I completely trusted it, even though I didn't know what it was about. So you get to recognize when you can trust it and when you can't. I don't know, do you have an example of when you might not want to trust it?
Yes.
Yeah?
Do
you want to say it? Do you want to share it?
Yeah.
Right now.
Well, sometimes I do, I have hateful instincts, for instance, but you know, a nice example also is like when I went out with a girl and I wanted to kiss her, but I don't think I should, because it wasn't in the moment, it was, it felt like you can't kiss a girl on the first date, you know, you can't. So, that kind of thing.
Yes, yeah, that's a good example actually, because we can be then caught by our desire, and really the desire can be really strong, and we really like this woman, and oh, wow, yeah, I really want to do this. And then, but we might look then at the greater situation and say, okay, wait, you know, I don't know if it's because you can't, that's maybe a belief, you can't kiss someone on a first date, I don't know. But maybe the situation isn't such, sometimes we make mistakes, you know, sometimes the woman says, whoa, no. Or it might be the opposite, wow, I'm glad you did that, I don't know. it's true. You know, we have to maybe take a moment and say, okay, wait, is this just like, am I really just being intoxicated by my desire? Or is this, you know, maybe this is appropriate in this moment? Sometimes in that kind of situation, it's difficult because, you know, like falling in love is such a thing that, I'm not saying you fell in love with this woman, but falling in love is it's actually, and we become kind of insane, you know, we lose all, we lose everything, we lose all contact, we lose all sense of what's right and what's not right, and...
That's why it's falling.
What?
That's why it's falling.
Yeah, absolutely, exactly, that's why it's falling. And yet there's something about falling in love that is, we know our gut is right. So yeah, that's a good point though about the desire, and then you still have to stay with the situation and what's appropriate.
And there's maybe if there's a conflicting emotion, this can be, if it's a gut feeling coming from conflicting emotion,
yeah,
we really need to, it's not from a conflicting emotion, we are at ease, but there's something strong, maybe. It's more trustworthy.
It's true. Yeah.
Like passion or hate, those gut feelings.
Absolutely.
Hate, and it's not the right thing to do.
I was thinking about the notion of belief, right, as an attachment to a particular form of seeing. But that the problem with it is that it's too conscious. We're not, you know, belief is too conscious a concept in itself. So for instance, very often you're talking about COVID, you know, the experience of saying, how is this happening to me? I think one explanation for it, it's not the explanation for it, but one explanation for it is that very often we carry defenses that are unconscious or semi-conscious, and one of the defenses that we carry is specialness. I'm not somebody who's, you know, going to have terrible things happening to them because I am special at some level. But then a terrible thing happens and then we realize that the fence has been there all along, you know? And you have that moment of realizing, oh, I've been going around this false sense of protection thinking that I'm special and I've got COVID. So then, you know, then we have to soften to that and the sadness of that and all of that so that we can access other things. So I think belief is too conscious a concept very often. That's part of the problem. But I suppose that I've, you know, we're talking about your mother, I was thinking about my mother. Not that our mothers are similar, because I don't know a lot about your mother, only the bit that you've said. But yeah, but my mother is, she's you know, she's 73, 74 these days. You know, she's a beautiful 74-year-old woman. But when my mother was younger, she was like, she would stop the traffic, literally. You know, she was like Sophia Loren kind of beauty, you know. So I've the images of going with my mom, sort of you know, for a walk in the street and sort of men stopping in the street and sort of being kind of, you know, gobsmacked by her. She had like that kind of beauty, you know, she was always known for having that kind of beauty. And she's sort of, you know, it's been really tough for her to let go of that because that was who she is, who she was all her life. And when she sort of sees people these days, she has a very strong aesthetic appreciation that she offers to people involuntarily, whether they ask it or not. So with me, whenever I'm there with my hair short, the first thing that she will say, oh, you got your hair short, it makes your face look squalid, I really don't like it, it doesn't favour you. You know, and sometimes I have to listen to that comment 3-4 times during a weekend, you know, to try and persuade her to go and not cut my hair so short, you know, the next time. And so what I do these days, you know, and it really used to get me upset, so what I do these days is that I do a joke with it in that I preempt her movements, you know, so that we both go into not knowing, you know. So when I saw her last, I said, hey, how are you? Looking good. You know what? I've got my hair short that way you don't like. My face looks squalid. You're probably going to give me that comment several times in the weekend. Let's just get it out of the way. I know you don't like this. Is that okay? All right. And then we're both in silence for a bit because no one quite knows what to say next. But also I've distilled the anger and the upset. So when it comes out as a joke. But then we don't know where we go next because that's generally the ritual. So I'm very interested in this sort of thing where, you know, we look into belief, the belief being my mother disapproves of my looks because she's very look obsessed. Then we sort of go behind or beneath, beside belief, we see the emotion. It's so sad that my mother is still stuck in that perception of beauty or value of beauty and that she tries to bring me into that as well. It's so, there's such separation in that, you know. Then you think, what can I do with this now that I felt the sadness? Let me make a joke. And then we both know into go into not knowing and we'll see. You know, and I think there's softening in that.
Well, and in that case, so is your motivation to do this because, like Krisha, you do want to have contact with your mother because you could take a different path and just say, well, I'm not going to go there anymore.
I could. I think my motivation is also self-centered. It gets me upset, that kind of comment, so I don't want to be upset with her.
Right.
And then the second motivation is that I want to be with her, but outside of that fixation for beauty and aesthetics that she has, and see what else where else can we be.
I'll just be and let go of it all. Can't control your mother. She's not doing... It's just a perspective.
Mm. Can I say something?
Miguel is going to talk about my mother.
Really?
You know her mother?
It's about
this.
It's come from this similar place. Our belief in something, or identification with something. In this case, I think it's common to all of us, the identification with being human. So we understand, I think we all can understand what that we are spiritual beings living in a human form and sometimes experiencing that, and so believing that it's true, confirming, I'd say. But at the same time, there is this identification that Pedro was speaking, that I am a human being, and this belief really struggles to not letting go, to being, to be what, yeah, infinite and so in sense a way to approach this, it's being that, whatever it is, struggle, identification, fear, resistance, all of that, it's experiencing that, being that, with no separation.
So say that again, just last bit,
so,
say that again.
There is this notion of me being a human being that have fear of letting go to the infinite, whatever, to being what's true. And acknowledging that it's there and it's just an illusion, it doesn't, sometimes it goes, but most of the time it's there. It comes. It's here. And having compassion, yeah, it's better. It works better. But it doesn't solve the case.
Because this, when you say it doesn't solve the case, you mean it doesn't make the fear and the... doesn't make
because
it end?
In a subtle way, it still has two.
Mm-hmm.
Compassion, being in the compassion, acknowledging fear or whatever, and okay, yeah, fear, it's okay to have fear, and so but it seems that, yes, yeah, sometimes it's dissolving, but then it comes again, and I'm not saying that there is because the attitude it makes all the difference. When we have an attitude to solve something, it doesn't work. Well, it depends on what it is, but not in this case. So The thing here, it's to close the separation between what it's not separation, the being in itself, spiritual being, as you said, and this human, this sense of human being that doesn't want to let go. It's just be that fear.
Yeah, I mean, that's maybe one way of saying it or approaching it. Because, yes, the human is caught in the separateness of the separation, and that's where the fear comes from, actually. It's from that sense of separation and being isolated and being alone, being rejected, being abandoned, whatever, however that the human experiences it. But in fact, they're not two. It's like the Confucian thing of, you know, we have two lives, and the second one begins when we see we only have one. So there's, maybe, you know, we could look at it as we identify with, you know, sometimes teachers present this in terms of consciousness or awareness, where usually we identify, first we're really familiar with the objects and we identify with the objects. We see the object and me, so there's this separation. We can distance ourselves then from the object, so there's this fear.
Mm-hmm.
There's me who's experiencing the fear. Then we identify with the me, the one who's experiencing the fear. We identify very closely with that. So can we're aware of the fear and we're aware of the I who fears, but can we take the step back and identify with the awareness and see that the I who is experiencing the fear is also just an object in the, that changes then the way that we see it. Then we take a step into the spiritual. But it's not that it's an illusion, I mean it is, but it's, we really truly have to experience it. That's why when we say be one with it, it's we really have to experience it. You have to really experience the fear or the doubt or the not having another breath. You know, when we tell our stories of that, we've really experienced that. And that's what, when we are one with whatever it is, when we can, that's just a jargon to say be one with it. But it really does mean not, sometimes we use this image of when we're in despair, we say we're in a dark tunnel or something. And there's hope that there's a light at the end of the tunnel. So we say we see that there's a light at the end of the tunnel. But as soon as we start seeing the light at the end of the tunnel, we're no longer really in the dark tunnel. And we're looking for an escape. And we're focusing on the way out instead of just being here. So in that sense, yes, it involves just really being there with what it, being whatever it is.
Being it.
Not, you know, becoming a martyr and indulging in the suffering and the pain. But.
Okay, but that's really tricky. Because if you have a dark side and somehow it's just terror, just dark, just not knowing and fear, if you become it and you have this human experience, you will be that.
Well, when we say become it or be one with it, it doesn't mean that then everything becomes terror or something like that. It means that we stop trying to control it and reject it. We allow it to be. It doesn't mean that we like it, and it doesn't mean that we won't seek help if we need it. If we're lost, wandering around in the streets of Lisbon, we don't know where we are. Of course, now we have telephones. But so instead of just wandering around and being one with being lost, pick up the telephone, connect, and find who you are and find a way to go. You know, it doesn't mean being one with being lost. It means acknowledging, okay, I'm lost. Right?
Okay, but imagine her experience.
Mm-hmm.
So she's breathing with a lot of difficulties. She's thinking she might die or the next breath maybe not there to be breathing the next go for the DR. How can she be with that fully be?
Well, usually what happens in
not,
experience,
you know,
like
panic.
What,
because
okay,
she's
yes,
human.
So,
yeah.
Because usually what happens, so the panic is already separating from the experience.
Yes.
It's projecting into what
am I going to
what's
die?
What's
going to
happen?
Yeah.
It's already moving away from it. I know, of course, I don't have asthma, but in my case, when I had was really having difficulty breathing with COVID, if I could just drop the trying to, you know, the projecting and the anxiety and all of that, and try to just find a way to be comfortable in that situation, so not sleep lying down, but sleep sitting up. Like we say, you know, the pain is inevitable, but suffering is optional.
Mm-hmm.
We add that on with our projecting and our attaching and our wanting it to be different.
Not wanting that experience.
Right.
Yeah.
And there is also this, if you are with it, you are really this moment, it kind of make it easier for you.
Yeah.
And something vanishes too.
Yeah, no, I understand completely.
Yeah.
I'm just pointing, you know, this is a concrete situation.
Right.
When we have dark places, usually they are mental, but they are beliefs, something that we are believing and it's not there. But it's really tough to be the one with it.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost felt like it's almost a craziness. You get too lost, too ungrounded.
Well, it's almost, you know, in a case like that, it's almost like it has to do with acknowledging it, you
mm-hmm.
know, admitting it. I'm really in a dark place, you know, this is really dark. Totally acknowledging it. And then, because we've acknowledged it, we can see, oh, I need help.
Mm-hmm.
You have no idea what that help is going to be, how it's going to work, where it's going to take you, but you becoming one with it means, you know, we have that chant in the morning in our retreats, the verse of atonement.
Mm-hmm.
So that means becoming, atone is at one. So becoming one with whatever it is. So acknowledging the suffering I've created, acknowledging the suffering I'm experiencing, acknowledging whatever it is. That's what it is to be fully whatever it is.
One with it.
Yeah,
yeah, you just added dimension. It looks like you are saying is caring. You are adding.
What?
Adding and not just be with it. Be with it with care. Perhaps, yeah, this is a really dark spot. Maybe I need help. Maybe I acknowledge that this is too much for me.
Uh-huh.
And that doesn't feel so diving into a hole. Yeah.
Right.
And another reaction is when we are really, when we encounter something that it's very painful, yeah, not running away from it,
right.
Mm-hmm.
Then we acknowledge that actually it doesn't have the solidity that we were being.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly.
So
mm-hmm.
Experiences. Maybe it's not that bad, or it's not so dramatic as
wolf.
We.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
The big bad wolf.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly. What is the time?
1:15.
Ah, so we're way.
Where you are?
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So.
Just so fruitful that.
But the food is already made.
Yes.
Oh, hopefully,
true.
Hopefully.
Sorry for Debbie. It's late for her. It's late for her there in Paris, but. Okay. No.
Construct the questions after your answer.
Well, there will be a recording you can hear to fill in the blanks.
I think she needs to be closer.
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah. Well, we're finished for now. Okay. So, okay. Thank you. So now we will have our.
I was going to ask if we've seen before once. No.
So the lunch break. Let's stay with the silence again.